volunteers, raising funds to allow continuous operations in compliance with the Pacifica mission, FCC, nonprofit 501c3 requirements, Pacifica bylaws, and board resolutions. Experience with community broadcast operations is valued. Interested in the KPFT general manager position? Then go to Pacifica.org for details to apply. Applications accepted no later than September 13, 2020. Pacifica Foundation, Inc. is an equal opportunity employer. This is PacificaKPFT.org, 90.1 FM, Houston.
Signals that it's 8 p.m. on Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling. And it's only here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. Tonight we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls and transport us to a montage of magical worlds before returning us safely to the present, which is back here in the gallery. We're not in the station today. Woo-hoo. I'm Harwood Taylor, gallery director at Grimion and Company Fine Art. Actually, I'm the co-director with Trish Matute. And I'm super excited to be here tonight co-hosting the show with my good friend Chris Gorman. We really love the show, and we're always excited to help out in any way we can. Kudos to Dr. Hank Rubicek for having the vision and determination to start So What's Your Story so many years ago, and for the amazing community that has formed around it. We would also like to acknowledge the hard work of our fellow hosts, Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, Eric Heen, Paul Topikian, and the entire So What's Your Story team as we all navigate new ways to bring these shows and connect both with stories and with you, our valuable and amazing audience. Chris and I are grateful for all of you.
2020 has been strange in so many different ways. One thing I never thought I would have given my attention to in the way that it has recently is the United States Postal Service. Like a light switch that you flip up and expect a room to fill with light, it is easy to dismiss things that are always reliable and take them for granted. With the future of the USPS thrown into jeopardy lately, the simple act of sending a letter seems urgent and precious in a way that I've never experienced before. If we can't physically be with those we care about, a letter can be so caring and encouraging to the receiver, and honestly, to the sender as well. So what does that have to do with stories, you might ask? Historically, people who have been separated from those they care about by circumstances like war, distance, illness, and even a star-crossed romance or two shared each other's lives through letters. Many of these letters contain incredible stories and have stood the test of time, often reread to give a taste of another time, another life. Tonight we are going to play with that idea as we hear some stories that we love. Maybe every person's story is like a letter to a curious reader in the future. Let's sit with that idea as we listen to some stories and enjoy.
Our first teller is Stephanie Betts. I met Stephanie through Iris Sizemore and Jackson Shaw. who are dear friends of mine. Iris has the longest running group of women, it's called the Women's Group, meeting weekly in the United States, 44 years running. And Stephanie found Iris through the Women's Group. And Iris told me that I had to talk to Stephanie Betts, that she was a storyteller, and she is. I'm so glad I did, and I'm so glad you're here with me today. Stephanie is a writer, she's an artist, she's a poet, and she's a socially and spiritually conscious human being. So, Stephanie, what's your story?
This story is called Moral Dilemma, and it's about a dilemma that I faced when I was 12 years old. I was raised and born in Chicago, Illinois. And when I was 12 years old, I went to the local grammar school like everybody else. Only we were having social upheavals, mainly in the form of residence, where to live, how to live. And from my understanding, at 12 years old, black people were being forced to live in a very constrained elements, and some of the apartments that we were given were less than favorable. And so it was a big issue in our community, and nationally it was an issue. So Martin Luther King Jr. actually moved to Chicago in 1966 to live there to try to address some of the inequalities. And while he was there, during one particular winter, that particular winter, he was slated to come down the streets and give a parade, and we were there to offer moral support. I went to Holland, John Holland School, and along that route, there were two major schools. So, like any good community, they lined us up all outside, but it was cold. Chicago gets really cold, so it was a bitter cold day, the kind that you see white frost on the streets. And They had told us that Martin Luther King was going to make an appearance, and we didn't know when, so every day we were spit-shined in anticipation of Martin Luther King coming. So in the school, there was a family of maybe three or four girls, and I won't give their name, but they all went to school, and they were, if not classmates, they were in an adjacent class. One of the things about this particular family is they were always immaculate. Their hair was always combed. Their shoes were always laced. They were just beautifully coiffed. And one of the people in particular, I'll call her Terry, she was particularly troublesome. I don't know what was going on with the family, but there were some issues in the family, but she was always fighting and getting into trouble, being sent to the truant officer. You know, she was just, something was going on that was causing her mental anguish, and she would bring it to school and act out. So this particular day, the great Martin Luther King, who we affectionately knew as the Prince of Peace, the Prince of Peace was going to actually be paraded down the street. So all primed and preened, they got us outside, they lined us up, and we were standing out there shaking in our little boots, you know, just waiting for Martin Luther King, the Prince of Peace, the Prince of Peace is coming. So as we were standing out there, we were lined up, and we were next to the class that Terry happened to be in. Well, Terry didn't normally, she wasn't normally around me or I wasn't near her, but this particular day she was standing beside me. And so we were sitting out there maybe 15 or 20 minutes, and she was getting a little bored. We all were, and we were getting a little antsy as kids do, and, you know, complained about the cold, yada, yada. But she wanted to create some kind of disturbance. So she decided that we should jump. And she said, come on, everybody, let's jump, jump, jump. And so, you know, nobody wanted to jump, and nobody did jump. So we all just kind of like, get out of here. So she starts, because she was standing directly next to me, she started pulling the sleeve of my coat. And she said, come on, come on, let's jump, let's jump. And I was like, get off of me, stop, you know. And I didn't want a problem.
Right.
But I wanted her to stop. And she settled down for a minute, and we noticed that we were getting the attention of the adults who was at the end of our row. They turned around and looked at us, so I was terrified. I snapped to attention and stood there. And as soon as they turned back around, she started again. And she said, come on, jump, jump. You know, we can do it, jump, jump. And I was thinking, listen, leave me alone and stop pulling on me, you know. So again, we were getting too much attention. And I just tried to ignore her, but a third time she came to me and she started pulling on my coat, jump, jump. So me, and maybe she saw that I was the type that would acquiesce in an attempt to get out of trouble. I jumped. I started jumping up and down. And where did I land? Squarely on her foot. Well, besides them being immaculately dressed and up to date, she had on a pair of canvas white shoes that we called white girls. You only wore them on special occasions because they were canvas white, and they were notoriously getting dirty, so you always had to clean them, keep them clean. So I came down squarely on the front of her white girl gym shoes. And instantly there was all this, ooh, oh my goodness, you stepped on her gym shoes. Whoa, now this was a sin. White girls were the Air Jordan gym shoes of that day.
Okay.
So here I had stepped on her white girl gym shoes. And so she reared back and put her hands on her hips and said, okay, you stepped on my gym shoes. You better clean them off. So my first response was, hey, if you hadn't been pulling on me, this wouldn't have happened. But not wanting to cause further dismay with all the oohs and the ahs and all the information going back and forth and the kids getting ready for whatever's going to happen, I said, too bad, you know, and kind of brushed it off. And she said, you stepped on my gym shoes. You better clean them off. So I actually said, I'm not cleaning off your gym shoes because if you hadn't been pulling on me, your gym shoes wouldn't have got stepped on. So then again, it became more rambunctious, you know. Oh, she stepped on your gym shoes. What you going to do?
Oh, boy.
You know, the kids going back. Terrible. So finally,
stir the pot.
It was really getting agitated. So I started looking around. I saw the teacher looking over. And I said, oh, crap. I said, okay, I'll tell you what. So I leaned down, brushed off the shoes, like, here you go. Done. Now leave me alone. I can clearly see the big footprint on the white girl gym shoes, which inside I was thinking, well, that little thing didn't do it. But I was also insulted because I had really tried to brush them off, and there was no getting around it. You cannot get this print off. So she said, that's not good enough. So I said, okay, well, hey, suck it up because that's all you got. So then she reached out to put her hands on me. Okay, now, unbeknownst to us, the motorcade had started down the street with the Prince of Peace. So while we were having all this agitation, the motorcycles and the cars was going past, and we hadn't paid any attention to it because we was having this thing.
Oh, boy.
The bottom line is, when she reached out and put her hands on me, that was the last straw.
Mm-hmm.
So I was raised, you know, in a hard environment. I knew exactly what to do. I came back with the right hook. So we started fighting. I mean, we were just going at it. This wasn't a little girl's fight either where you do a little flailing of hand. This was punches. So we started punching and fighting, and all the kids was running around and moving around. And then, I don't know, the next thing I know, we were out in the street rolling.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
And the kids were screaming and yelling, and the teachers were looking, and then the next thing I know, they ran over and they separated us, and I looked up, and there standing over the motorcade was none other but Dr. Martin Luther King.
Wow.
And I'll never forget the look in his eye as he was watching us rolling in the street fighting. And I felt just so unbelievable downtrodden. Mm. I felt embarrassed. Mm. And I felt, my God, you know, this is something that you just don't do. And you certainly don't do it for the Prince of Peace. And I knew my mother and my father was going to be just enraged with me for getting caught in this situation. I just felt really, really like a piece of crap. Mm. Anyway, the teachers grabbed us and shoved us up and they ran us into the office. And the motorcade went by. The rest of the afternoon was filled with going back and getting the story. Who said what? Who did what? You know, how it happened. And to my credit, because I wasn't a troublemaker, you know, I wasn't the kind of kid that was always starting fights. And in fact, Terry was. They had gone to their limits with her. Mm. They had warned her before that if she continued with her bad behavior, she was going to have to be taken out of class and sent to Montefiore, which was where they sent delinquent kids, bad kids, and kids that didn't have any parents.
Mm.
Well, we had all heard stories about Montefiore, and Montefiore was a place, it was like prison, or like the crazy house, Nobody wanted to go. So they sent me back up to my classroom feeling really bad, and they said, don't worry about it. And I thought when I got home I was going to get shaken down by my parents, my aunts, community people, you know. But they had gotten a story, and they heard that, in fact, Terry had incited this and had started this. Mm. And so I heard later that Terry was, in fact, being shipped to Montefiore. And it almost broke my heart.
That's sad.
Because, you know, where I thought she was troubled, and I knew she was mean, and she had, in fact, started it. You just didn't want anybody to go to Montefiore. You knew it meant breaking up their family. You knew it was just going to be terrible. And again, I had that look of Martin Luther staring me in the eye as he was staring over the motorcade. It took me a couple of weeks to get past that. It really did. I just felt horrible. And school went on. Life went on. We got up every day. We went back to school. We got through it. But I was upset, even though I know that they didn't hold me accountable for it. I was just terribly upset. I felt bad for Terry, that, because God only knows what was going on with her. And maybe about three or four months later, her cousin, who was in another class, one day we happened to be sitting next to each other, and I just kind of asked her about it, you know. And she said, she comforted me. She said, don't worry about it, she's okay. And she said, it wasn't your fault. And she was, you know, that's something that happened to her and it wasn't good, but it was something that she caused.
Yeah.
So don't worry about it. And it kind of relieved me a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, I can imagine.
But I always felt like that was a moral dilemma that I was put in at the age of 12. I was conscious enough to understand the Prince of Peace, the concept of peace. But I was also young enough not to know how to extricate myself when you're confronted with real violence.
That's a big lesson to learn. Like, how do you de-escalate?
What do you do?
How do you withdraw yourself in a,
right,
in a way? And boundaries. I mean, I'm 56 and I'm still learning that stuff.
Well, it was a terrible situation, and I never forgot it, and I always wanted to know what happened to Terry. I didn't, you know, and life went on, I forgot about it, but it impacted me. Impacted me deeply. It impacted me looking at him, looking at us, and I couldn't imagine what was going through his mind as he's there to instill peace. Mm-hmm. And then there's two little girls rolling around in the street in a fish brawl.
Yeah. Well, God, he probably seen so much, you know.
He might have thought, you know, I mean, looking back on it, he might have thought, oh, kids fight.
Right. Yeah.
That's what they do. They're kids. And you know, you can't predict that kind of thing. You can't. Sometimes he might have taken it very casually.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it wasn't a good sight for him either as he's making his motorcade, you know.
And what year was this again?
66.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
When you think back on that, you said it stayed with you. What do you think you brought from that story? You kind of already have said, but what do you think you... I mean, not that you have to have something to say, but there's a reason why we tell the stories we tell, you know? I mean, part of it is that it's very impactful. Like, I can get into the mind of a young person and imagine like somebody stepping on my special shoes, and they weren't, you know, it wasn't the same importance as it, I imagine this family was, and how you explained it. I can completely understand. And then having people stand around and kind of goat you to respond, yeah, what are you going to do? You know, just imagining that those childhood kind of cruelties that kids can do.
Well, I think doing today of social unrest.
Right.
I think the point is that sometimes you're forced, you're literally forced into a situation where you have to react.
Mm.
And it's not something that you want to do.
Right.
It's not your proudest moment, but you're actually forced and you have to respond in order to, or feel bad about yourself for the rest of your life, you know.
Mm.
And during these times of social unrest, when we're seeing all the Black Lives Matter, I think, you know, people are being forced to come up with something. They're being forced to react because they just can't take it anymore when you're being harassed and goaded on
right.
to a point of intolerance. Right. It's a natural human thing to react.
Sure.
Even though it might not be the reaction that you want
right.
or that you're proud of,
right.
you're forced to react just by the nature of being human.
And because this is a radio audience, I need to say you're a black woman.
That's
and,
right.
And you grew up in a very tumultuous time in a epicenter of that
that's right.
that
that's right.
conflict. So you know it intimately. You know.
That's right. During that, I didn't know, you know, until later just how grave the housing conflict was. I knew the conditions under which we were living and many of my neighbors. Understanding now how deep the impacted those people were and how our parents were struggling for just decent housing. Mm. That was all that they were asking for, is a decent place to live and raise their kids, you know. And then you have other things like people have social issues or mental issues because of that. Because
right.
I don't know what was going on in Terry's house, but I'm sure her overachieving with her outward appearance had something to do with their mental
sure.
self-worth.
Sure.
And that probably had something to do with the conditions under which they were being raised and which they were being living,
yeah.
the whole nine yards,
yeah.
because it all interlocks.
Sure, it's you all
know?
Related.
So I'm sure something was going on in her household that caused her to strike out
yeah.
in the manner in which she was.
Yeah, that's what I've...
So I just want, you know, when you look at it and people look back on places in history, you know, to really think about what those people were going through, because it's easy to come up with, you should have.
Right.
Stephanie, that was an amazing story.
It sure was.
I am so glad we got to hear it. We are lucky. And we're lucky to share it with our listeners here at So What's Your Story? One person who has written so very many important and eloquent letters is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., including his letter from Birmingham Jail. This letter particularly seems to speak to all of us in these important days of taking a careful look at systemic racism in our justice system. Written in 1963 as he was jailed along with some fellow protesters, he wrote this incredible line, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." This is something we can all use as a reminder every day.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks for reading that, Chris, and finding it. And, you know, something I realized that I did in, you know, talking with Stephanie was at some point I pointed out, just for the listening audience, because it's radio, that she's a black woman. What I didn't say is that I'm a white man. And I was thinking about why is that? And it's because I would assume that they knew I'm a white man. And that is what it's kind of all about, this really just unconscious amount of sort of privilege that we have that, I don't know, it's not a justice program. It's about storytelling, but that there's quite a story there, you know. And
yeah.
I remember when I was in 1983, when I was sacking groceries, at Jemail's, and Oprah magazine came out, and it was the first time I'd looked at O magazine, and I remember seeing black people in the advertisements, and it was just like, that's so strange. And then it was very strange to me that was so strange to me, which meant that I had never seen it before. I just anyway, I'm grateful as the world gets more open, and even though these are rough, you know, society changing and growing can be painful. I'm glad that I think more of us are aware, are trying to be, than probably we were only a year ago.
I think we're trying to listen to everyone's story.
Yeah.
There are some stories that we haven't heard.
That's right.
And we need to listen up and
yeah.
listen close, because everybody's story is valuable.
Yeah.
And this is a good time to open your ears, maybe close your mouth for a minute, as someone who talks too much.
Shut up.
I know, it's painful information.
All right. Our next teller is going to be Chris Gorman. Chris is a wonderful speaker, a wonderful storyteller, especially personal narratives, which is what she does with The Moth. She's told live stage events as a paid teller, but she's also won the Houston Moth Story Slam 5 times. She's a dear friend, and I'm so glad that we get to have this story on So What's Your Story, because it was also just a week ago. Chris and her story represented Texas and Houston in the first National Central Moth Slam. That's a lot of qualifiers, but anyway, it was the central part of the country, the very first time that multiple states competed against each other, and Chris represented Texas. So we're going to hear that story next. So what's your story, Chris?
There is nothing wholesome that you can do in this town after midnight, my mother would say. I couldn't argue with her. I had tested her theory repeatedly. She was correct. But it seemed like most of my classmates in high school were pretty fine with the status quo. You know, Friday night football, homecoming, prom. But me and my weirdo friends, we just felt like we needed something bigger, something more. And we were studying for our SATs, but we hadn't found out yet that algebra doesn't really help you in real life. We just thought if you had a problem, you could always solve for X. So if you have 5 wannabe cool teenagers that have a burning need to dance for at least 15 minutes in a big city nightclub, what time would they need to leave their small Texas town? And by how much would they need to exceed the speed limit in order to get home in time for somebody's lame-ass curfew? That was me with the early curfew. So every Friday, we'd rush home from high school, work on our look, and then pack ourselves into somebody's mother's car, and then haul ass into Houston to dance at a club called Numbers. And there were other clubs we could have gone to, but Numbers was a club that we knew we could get into under 21. And that was fine, because we were not going there to drink or to do drugs. We just needed some space, you know, to try some stuff out, see who we were going to be. And if you had went into Numbers in the 80s, it was like walking into the cantina in Star Wars. People in there were trying out virtually everything. Okay, hold on, brace yourself. I'm going to just fast forward to 2020. Don't be scared. Yeah, I said 2020. So I moved to Houston. I've lived in Houston for almost 30 years now. And so happens I live about 2 miles away from that very same dance club where we all went to dance in high school, Numbers. This year is Numbers' 42nd year anniversary. And I have a new weirdo group of friends. And every Friday, we rush home from work, pack ourselves into somebody's car, and then go and dance at Numbers. But they call it classic Numbers on Fridays because they play the same music that we used to dance to in high school, because we're vintage people. I'm 49 years old, and I will have you know that my curfew is a lot later than it used to be. But it was just nice, you know, to have something that stays the same, you know, the same pockmarked dance floor, the same stinky fog machine. Up until March of this year, that's when COVID-19 closed down all the bars and clubs in Houston. And I would prowl through Numbers' Facebook page just to see if they had posted a reopening date. Because if they had, I might have gone ahead and gotten in line. I missed it so much. It just seemed like everything that was good and fun on my schedule was just withering up and falling away, just like a houseplant that somebody forgot to water. But one day, when I looked on Facebook, Numbers said they were adding an event. The DJ, Wes Wallace, had decided to start spinning records from his home. And I'm like, wow, that is not going to be fun at all. But then I tuned in, and the first thing I saw was that he had taken down the glitter disco ball from over the dance floor and hung it in his study. And as it turned, it made little dappled pieces of light that fell on his 2 turntables, that fell on his million records, that fell on his 2 ginormous cats. And then he played my jam. And I don't know what your jam is, but my jam is a song where when you play that song, I'm going to have to dance. So I went in my foyer and I did a little get down, and it just felt so good. I hadn't danced in months. And, you know, I think a lot of people had that same experience, because people started showing up to this by the hundreds, and it just got bigger. He had to move it to one of those streaming apps, you know, like the kind where the kids watch each other play Fortnite. And this streaming app had something that the dance floor never did. It had a chat function. You could log in under some dumb name like Douglas in Darkness 89 and talk. And people did. 4 hours. I mean, we had danced together forever, but we had never talked before. It was too loud. But it was amazing watching people having 10 and 20 different conversations all at the same time. Who wrote this song? I hate this song. I made chicken parmesan. I saw this band in concert in 1992. Hey, I got my old job back at the AutoZone. My mother is sick. Every time this song comes on, my 8-year-old just rolls his eyes. Seriously, Mom? This one? Again? If you can't be in the presence of one real person, having 50 virtual people tell you hello, you know, that's a really powerful thing. So every time they would pass the virtual tip jar or ask for virtual cover, I pay it happily. It just feels like tithing to me. And if you told the 18-year-old version of me that my dance club was thinking about having a potluck dinner, oh, 18-year-old me would be mortified. But this 49-year-old 2020 version of me just thinks that's really cool and wants to know, when are we going to be able to have it, and what do they need me to bring?
I love that story, Chris. Hey, this is just a little piece that I this is one of my favorite stories, and all of your stories are my favorite stories, but
that's why you're a good friend.
Well, maybe so. As my dad would say, I'd give him a compliment and he'd say, well, you're kin.
Exactly.
So I just want, you know, just a tip about sort of our process, because we're sort of we help each other, you know, make stories. And Chris had a really wonderful story that she was going to tell at this national Moth Slam event, and it was really good. But she had been talking about this live stream every week for months in a very poetic kind of way. And so I gingerly sort of said, hey, Chris, I love your story, and I'm not trying to stress you out by making you write a new story. But
Yikes.
But what about the live stream? And she kind of lit up. And she goes, oh, that's a good idea, but I don't know. And I said, well, just think about it. Anyway, so I'm just saying, Chris's mantra and every storytelling mantra that I know of, whether it's personal narrative, which is what we're doing tonight, some of which we're doing tonight, or a fairy tale, which I'll tell later, they got to be stuff you care about, or it just comes through. And you obviously care about that. Anyway, I love that story, Chris.
Well, as a person who's been sequestered in their home, like a lot of other people, it's really great having some, you know, quote unquote friends to talk to, even if you're not exactly sure who they are. Maybe that's even better, because you're using a dumb name and they are using a dumb name, and you can talk about whatever you want. And just to kind of tie this back to the letter thing that we're talking about tonight, I would like, if I was to write a letter to my past self or to my future self regarding this, I would want my future self to know that even though this was a hard time, I wasn't miserable all the time. There were things that I found delight in, and this was one of the things. And I would write a letter and say, you know, even if you're having a hard time and nothing seems good, there's always something that can light you up and make you happy. Maybe sometimes you got to look for it in an unexpected place, future me, or, you know, I'd want to remind future me about that, and I would send her a letter and then drop it in the post box that sends letters to the future.
Lovely.
Well, thank you again, Chris.
Good night, people.
Just because a lot of us are spending a lot of time at home, we kind of have stay-at-home lives, some of us do, it doesn't mean you have no human connection, not if you turn to storytelling as a method for embracing those you love. And even in a pandemic, there are terrific venues in town to help you develop some cool storytelling skills. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30. When we return to face-to-face world, the Guild holds its swap at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. But for now, we're having a ton of folks from all over the country join us, zooming in and having a ball. Visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for the Zoom link and for information about all our upcoming events. While you're on the site, enjoy our past So What's Your Story programs, all of them, since 2008, listed on the menu under Radio Program. A radio program sounds like old-fashioned these days, but when you can tune in every week to our award-winning program because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org without a radio. So, right, you just do it from your phone or your computer. You get to know us by visiting So What's Your Story Facebook page, and be sure to share it with friends. And we'd love it if you'd like us when you leave. Got a program idea, maybe guests you have in mind, maybe yourself, maybe you want to tell a story. Let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. Our friends at The Moth may not be packing into Warehouse Live, but you can catch them online, including nationwide story slams you will love. It just so happens that our very own Chris Gorman, my guest host tonight, was on the National Storytelling, the very first multi-state central U.S. Zoom last night. And in my humble opinion, she won. She didn't really win, but it doesn't matter. It is a ball, and I think you'll enjoy tuning in. And for anyone wanting to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? That's it for our announcements.
Okay, Harwood, you know that there is nothing I like hearing or telling more than a fairy tale. You know, I don't think there should be any show for So What's Your Story that doesn't have a fairy tale in it. So yeah, we're having a fairy tale. Sir, whenever you're ready, this is Harwood Taylor, and his fairy tale is called The Sea Hare.
The Little Sea Hare.
Not the Big Sea Hare. The Little Sea Hare.
And this was written by the Brothers Grimm. It's a Grimm's fairy tale from somewhere between 1812 and 1815. This is an old one.
All right, it's an oldie but a goodie. Bring it on.
All right. The Little Sea Hare, otherwise known as Das Meerhaschen.
Wow.
There was once upon a time a princess who, under the battlements in her castle, had an apartment with 12 windows which looked out in every possible direction. And when she climbed up to it and looked around, she could inspect her whole kingdom. When she looked out the first, her sight was more keen than that of any other human being. From the second, she could see still better. From the third, more distinctly still. And so it went until the 12th, from which she could see everything. Earth, under the earth, and nothing at all could be kept secret from her. Moreover, as she was haughty, so that's kind of an old-fashioned word for bitchy.
Wow.
And would be subject to no one, but wished to keep the domain for herself, she caused it to be proclaimed that no one should ever be her husband who could not conceal himself from her so effectively that it should be impossible for her to find him. And he who tried this, if discovered by her, she would strike their head off and stick it on a post. 97 posts with heads of dead men were already standing before the castle. And no one had come forward for a long time. I certainly wouldn't have.
Understandably.
The princess was delighted and thought to herself, now I shall be free as long as I live. Then three brothers appeared. And they announced to her that they wanted to try their luck. The eldest believed he would be quite safe if he crept into a lime pit, but she saw him from the first window, made him come out, had his head cut off, stuck it on a pole. The second crept into the cellar of the palace. She perceived him also from the first window, and his fate was sealed. His head was placed on the 99th post, and then the youngest came to her. He was smitten, and he wanted her consideration. He also wanted to know if she'd be so gracious as to overlook if she should happen to discover him twice, but if he failed the third time, he would look on his life as over. So he was really handsome, and he begged earnestly. He really was smitten with her, so she said, okay. The next day, he meditated on it for a long time. How should he hide? But nothing came to him. Then he seized his gun and he went out hunting. And he saw this raven and he took aim. And the raven said, wait a minute, don't shoot. I'll reward you. So he put his gun down. He went on, came to a lake where he was surprised that a large fish had come from the depths below to the surface, from the depth below to the surface. When he aimed his gun again at the fish cried, don't shoot, and I'll reward you. So he allowed it to dive down again, went onwards and met a fox, which was lame, would have been an easy kill. He fired and missed, and the fox cried, wait a minute, wait. You had better come up here and draw that thorn out of my foot for me. And he did this. But when he wanted to kill the fox and skin it, the fox said, stop, and I'll reward you. The youth let him go. And then as it was evening, returned home. The next day, he was to hide himself. No matter how he puzzled his brains over it, he just didn't know where. He went into the forest to the raven and said, I let you live on, so now tell me, where am I to hide myself so that the king's daughter will not see me? Ah, the raven hung his head and thought for a long time. And he said, you know what? I have it. He fetched an egg from his nest. He cut it in two parts and then shut the youth inside it and made it whole again and seated himself on it. When the king's daughter went to the first window, she couldn't discover him, nor could she from others. And she began to get uneasy, but from the 11th window, she saw him. She ordered the raven to be shot and the egg to be brought and broken, and the youth was forced to come out. She said, for once, you are excused, but if you don't do better, you're done. Next day, he went to the lake, called the fish to him, and said, I suffered you to live. Now tell me where to hide myself so that the king's daughter may not see me. The fish thought for a while and then cried, I have it. I will shut you up in my stomach. He swallowed him and went down to the bottom of the lake, and the king's daughter looked through her windows and even from the 11th did not see him and was alarmed. But at length from the 12th, she saw him. She ordered the fish to be caught and killed, and then the youth peered. It is easy to imagine the state of mind he was in. He was freaked. Well, first, he'd been in the fish's stomach and then
and cut open
and in an egg, right. She said, twice you've been forgiven, but be sure that your head will be set on the 100th post. On the last day, he went with a heavy heart into the country and met the fox. You know how to find all kinds of hiding places, he said, and I let you live. Now advise me where I should hide myself so that the king's daughter shall not discover me. Whew, that's a hard task, answered the fox. But he looked very thoughtful, and then he cried, I have it! And he went with him to the spring, dipped himself in it, and came out as a stall keeper in the market and dealer in animals. The youth had to dip himself in the water also and was changed into a small sea hare. The merchant went into the town and showed the pretty little animal, and many persons gathered together to see it at length. The king's daughter came as well, and she liked it very much, so much that she bought it and gave the merchant a great deal of money. But he gave it over to her. He said it quietly, he said, to the boy. He said, when the king's daughter goes to the window, creep quickly under the braids of her hair. And now the time arrived, and she was to search for him. She went to one window after the other, another in turn, and from the first to the 11th, and didn't see him. And when she didn't see him from the 12th, she was full of anxiety and anger. And she shut it down with such violence that it shattered every window in the castle. She went back and felt the sea hare beneath the braids of her hair. And then she seized it and threw it on the ground, exclaiming, away with you! Get out of my sight! It ran to the merchant, and both of them hurried to the spring where they plunged in to receive their true forms. The youth thanked him, and the fox said, the raven and the fish are idiots compared with you. You know the right tune to play. There's no denying that. The youth went straight to the palace. The princess was already expecting him and abandoned herself to her fate. The wedding was, pronounced, and now he was king and lord of the kingdom. He never told her where he had concealed himself for the third time and who had helped him, so she believed that he had done everything by his own skill. And she had great respect for him. She thought to herself, he's able to do more than I. The end. So,
did they live happily ever after?
That's the thing that I love about Grimm's fairy tales. And I'll tell you how I discovered this. I work in an art gallery, and there's a pretty famous artist named David Hockney that in 1969 did some etchings for that illustrated six, I think, Grimm's fairy tales. And the owner purchased them in the 70s. And I happened to come across them, and our show was coming up. And so it really isn't that I was just... I do love this story for several reasons. It's just these Grimm stories are so grim and so... The action is so driving. It's like there's not an extra word in it. You're always on to the next thing. I mean, somebody's head is getting... I mean, you start with the 97 heads on poles. I mean, you're in a fast-running story if you start with that. But I would just say sometimes just in our creative process, and part of this show is a creative process, just things come up, like Chris will say, hey, I read this fairy tale, and that's kind of how I felt. I read this fairy tale, and I'm like, I really want to read this. And, as far as a letter to myself in the future.
Or the past.
I would say that, I'm glad that sort of, I think a story like that grows out of the real pain that probably, you know, a woman of privilege but that didn't probably have power had to suffer in the past. And that, you know, I'm just, I would, you know, write to my past self that, you know, hopefully over time more and more of us have, you know, kind of are acknowledged for our talents, and not because we're rich or not because we're beautiful or not because of whatever, you know, our ethnicity or our, you know, how talented or not, that we're just, we're given respect as being a human being, having this mystical experience called being a human being. It's a kind of an amazing thing. The other thing that I think is really important that I've learned in some men's groups that I would write maybe a letter to my, maybe my future self, maybe just tomorrow, is just to ask for help. You know, that this guy was, he asked for help both from the person that, had demanded that everybody that looked, you know, get their head cut off. Like, she had pronounced that, and this guy comes along and says, hey, can you give me 3 chances? You know? And it's just a question, you know? And I like that. So he's basically asking for help from her. And then he's asking, and then each of the animals ask for help. Like, hey, don't shoot me. What about if I help you, you know? And then he's asking for their help. And I think even the princess, you know, that she keeps looking, that she's a, you know, that we look closer and closer for things. And that oftentimes, you know, treasures or fears are not far away. They're right on us. You know, like I heard once someone say, you know, standing on a whale fishing for minnows. You know, like, you know, like you're the thing you're trying to get is you're it. You know, that's what I would say. But you need help. That's what I'd say. Right now, we all need to, you know, help each other, I think. I hope. So that's what I got out of that story.
Okay, a couple questions.
Sure.
Someone could go online and look at these David Hockney etchings and think about this story. Is that something someone could do?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's what I did. Absolutely. Yeah, you can just do a... You can't look at the actual etchings. You'd have to come here.
Oh, that's a possibility. Put a mask on.
Yeah,
put a mask.
Put a mask on, all distance and so forth, but you're happy to. But you can also just look at them online.
Yeah, just look at an image of them and think about it.
Yeah, yeah. They're just, I think what I love about David Hockney is that, well, he just is a beautiful draftsman. But, you know, when you hear a story, it's kind of like when you hear an opera or you hear a good song with good lyrics. You know, you imagine like how that song embraces the words and back and forth, and it's kind of the same thing, how an artist would interpret the words of somebody that wrote something, you know, 200 plus years ago. This is 1815 1915 2015. It's, you know, well, anyway, it was a long time.
It's been a minute.
It's been a long time. And I think each one of the images is compelling all by itself without any story, you know. And I love that they're mysterious, you know, the boy and the fish and the boy and the egg. And
yeah, I think I read something about David Hockney, that he has an iPad and that he uses his iPad, just carries it around with him and just makes art wherever he is.
He did that for a while. I don't know if he's doing that now, but yeah, when they very first came out and they had the Paint app, yeah, he was doing some...
I really like that idea that an artist doesn't have to be in a, you know, an artistic situation to make some art. You know, to make it wherever you are, you know, there's the immediacy of wherever you are being the inspiration, whether it's a fairy tale or something you see out your back window or whatever.
The artists that paint from life and... it's not that they're better or worse than artists that don't, but it is the ones that I've come across that are really, really, really good draftsmen. It's because of that. It's because they never stop drawing. Like, they're just sitting at lunch and they're drawing you, or they're drawing a flower, or they're drawing a squirrel or a dog or a fish or whatever it is.
You know, that sounds like storytelling. You know, like, if you're a storyteller, it don't matter if you're talking about what you had for lunch or if you're talking about the Battle of 1812 or, you know, whatever the subject, it seems like you're always making a story of. out of something, whatever scraps you're given, right?
That's right.
One more question. What's a sea hare? Any thoughts? Any clue?
I gotta look it up.
Would you put it in your hair?
I
was just like, she put an animal in her hair.
Creepy. She put a hare in her hair.
She put a hare in the hair. Well, that's enough of that.
There's a hare in there.
That, how now, brown cow? I think that's plenty. All right.
Hey, and I just want to circle back and tell you just, you know, how important I think that story was that you told about numbers, that I just think that, you know, Warren, you know, I saw a comment that he made on Facebook about, you know, that in 5 minutes you were able to encapsulate, you know, kind of teenage angst and the experience of living through 2020. And you really were in a really thoughtful, fun, heartfelt way.
And well, if you're going to circle back to that, I'm going to circle back to Stephanie's story and say, you know, that was an amazing example of the macro and the micro. Something so immense was happening.
Right.
You know, like Dr. Martin Luther King was going to walk down her street in front of her. And then the micro, she got somebody's shoes dirty and there's a big fight. You know what I mean? Like, that big things happen and they are story worthy. And very, very small things are happening, and they are story-worthy. And when you have a story like that that has something so big and something so small, that's a very special story. So I am really grateful that Stephanie got to come and tell
story. Me too, yeah.
So, and if we, you know, that, I think we've almost completed the circle, except to say that I love fairy tales. So I'm always grateful when one can slide into So What's Your Story.
Indeed. We had a great time tonight, didn't we, Chris?
I always have fun.
I know. It's such a really wonderful thing to be able to connect with y'all out there in radio and digital land. We are so grateful for Stephanie Betts for coming on the show and look forward to hearing more stories from her at a later date. And thank you, Chris, for your wonderful story that was on the first Central States National Moth Super Slam, Grand Slam, that's right.
Sounds like what you eat at Denny's.
It does, it is. God's making me hungry.
Harwood, you did a great job on the show tonight. I just want to kudos you and your scary, scary fairy tale.
Thanks. And don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story. And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is...
I'm Chris.
And I'm Harwood Taylor. And along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Here early before they wake up. We stay late, we stay informed, we invest in the latest technology.
We take the time to train the next generation of doctors and nurses. We work together to make sure we heal their bodies and their minds.
We do this not because it's our job, but because this is about our veterans' lives. This is our mission. More than 300,000 of us working as one, together with families and loved ones. No matter where they live in this country, we'll be there.
We all come together and stand together to serve our veterans. We stand strong, united. Stand with us in caring for our veterans.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means.